Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Almost one child per second in Ukraine is becoming a refugee of the war, UN humanitarians said on Tuesday, as the total number of people who have now fled the country since the Russian invasion began passed 3 million, highlighting that 9 in 10 of those fleeing unrelenting violence in Ukraine are women and children. The UN Children's Fund UNICEF warned that youngsters are prey to traffickers as they arrive in unfamiliar new surroundings. The development follows a warning from the UN Secretary General, who on Monday said that Russia's military offensive against civilians was reaching terrifying proportions. At Ukraine's border with neighboring countries, overwhelming numbers of traumatized people have arrived, creating opportunities for criminal gangs who are known to flourish in conflicts, as UNICEF spokesperson James Elder told journalists in Geneva.
To give a sense of the border that I used to visit, the main border, Medyak, Poland to Ukraine, it is scores of people standing around buses and minivans calling out names of capital cities, or at least it was a week ago, and people getting onto those. The vast, vast majority, of course, are people with wonderful intentions and great generosity, but there is no doubt, given what we understand of trafficking in Europe, and that remains a very, very grave issue.
Staying with Ukraine, humanitarians warned that the situation in the port city of Mariupol has deteriorated further after more heavy Russian bombardment. Hundreds of thousands of people are being suffocated by a lack of supplies and are unable to flee the city besieged by Russian forces, said the International Committee for the Red Cross, ICRC. Spokesperson Ewan Watson also confirmed that a small number of vehicles had managed to get out of Mariupol on Monday, but this was just a drop in the ocean compared with those left behind. Amid reports that families are being forced to gather water from streams and that fights have broken out over food, Mr. Watson urged the Ukrainian and Russian authorities to find a solution so that aid can reach the city's people. To Myanmar, where security forces have killed at least 1,600 people and detained more than 12,500 since the military coup last year, the UN Rights Office said on Tuesday. In a new report warning that serious rights abuses uncovered in Myanmar may amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet appealed to the international community to take concerted, immediate measures to stem the spiral of violence there. The report's findings indicate that military and security forces bombarded populated areas with airstrikes and heavy weapons and deliberately targeted civilians. Many victims were shot in the head, burned to death, arbitrarily arrested, tortured or used as human shields, said UN Rights Office spokesperson Ravina Shamdasani.
Mass killings have taken place. In July, in Sagang region, soldiers killed 40 individuals in a series of raids. Villagers found the remains of some victims with their hands and feet still tied behind their backs.
At least 440,000 others have been displaced since the military takeover on the 1st of February 2021, the UN report said. A further 14 million are in need of urgent humanitarian assistance, but aid deliveries have been largely blocked by the military in new and pre-existing areas of need, it noted. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Yanis Varoufakis. Peace in Ukraine.
Biden could hold a summit with Putin. Russia withdraws from Ukraine. There is an agreement for the demilitarization of Donbas and the region around the borders between Ukraine and Russia. And both Russia and the United States guarantee the neutrality and independence of Ukraine.
On the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alice Smith.
Oh my God. You maniac! You blew it up!
How can we know the time of crisis has arrived? Is the panic heart beating? Or is it only mine?
So while on the one hand I think it's commendable if people want to see the world changed, and I think there is something within catastrophism which is, you know, genuinely something we can identify with, which is, you know, people want to see some fundamental change to society, and I think that's absolutely legitimate and fair, and I think that's actually possible, but catastrophism as a shortcut is not the way to get there.
For some reason, perhaps deep in our past, humans easily fixate on catastrophe, whether real or imaginary. Does the nation, the economy, or even civilization need to collapse in order to start anew? Who benefits if we think like that? And would things get better or worse? The producers of the long-running radio program Against the Grain teamed up with others to write an influential, if controversial, book about all that. It was published in 2012 with the title Catastrophism, The Apocalyptic Politics of Collapse and Rebirth. Now, why bring that back? Well, three reasons for me. Some listeners suggest I'm too fixated on collapse at the expense of solutions. Meanwhile, in America, Donald Trump and others in Europe feed on creating public fear. And finally, there are signs more people are afraid something awful is about to happen or already happening behind the scenes. Not to mention the signs of rapidly developing climate catastrophe, which is all too real. I've reached out to one of the authors, Eddie Yuen. Eddie teaches in the Urban Studies Department at the San Francisco Art Institute. He is the co-editor of the book Confronting Capitalism, Dispatches from a Global Movement. He's written about popular movements, the politics of right and left, and the role of apocalypse in environmentalism. Along with Sasha Lilly, another author in the book, Eddie has been a radio producer for Against the Grain on KPFA, the Pacifica flagship station in Berkeley and the Bay Area. Eddie Yuen, welcome to the public side of the microphone here on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
Well, why don't we start with a little question that probably has a huge answer, but why did you and your co-authors publish a book on catastrophism?
Yeah, well, back in 2012, we were having a conversation. We were struck by the fact that the end of the world, the concept of apocalypse and catastrophe, was ubiquitous in the popular culture and remains so. And we were interested in the politics of this. What are the politics of being constantly aware and reminded of the end of the world, the fact that it's in, you know, popular narratives, films, video games, what have you. We also were, of course, reminded of a famous quote some of your listeners might have heard from Frederick Jameson, which goes, it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism, right? And so the idea is, what does this do for the imagination, that we're so easily imagine various apocalyptic scenarios, but it's much harder to imagine alternatives to the system that's destroying human communities and certainly destroying the planet. So that was, you know, part of, it was an inquiry. We were interested in sort of making a map of different versions of catastrophe and the end of the world, and really especially concerned with the politics of this. But one thing that's clear, and when, you know, from the start, is we distinguish between some catastrophes which are not real, you might say spurious, especially right-wing ones, which are very much ubiquitous in the culture. You know, the stuff that Donald Trump promotes, the Republican Party in general, things about the government taking the guns every 4 years, they have this one, the gold bug kind of theories, Lou Dobbs's theory of immigrants spreading cholera, all these kinds of things, which bring about fear and panic. The distinction between those, the religious ones, which talk about the end of the world, we've had a few of those in recent years, and, of course, the real catastrophes, which are in fact happening, and principally I'm talking about the environmental catastrophes, which are in fact even worse than scientists a few years ago were predicting. In fact, this is not something in the future, it's ongoing, and the climate catastrophe is one of these scenarios. So it's absolutely real what's happening. It is catastrophic. And so our question is really, what politics emerge from these kinds of catastrophes? What politics are available to our imaginations? And so we go from there, you might say.
So in an earlier phone conversation, I shared with you the dirty little secret known by anyone in progressive radio. We get way more listeners when we talk about collapse and other awful things than when we do interviews about solutions. What does that tell us?
I think for one thing, I mean, it tells us that we are living in catastrophic times. I mean, it's on people's minds, whether politicized or not. There are so many different versions of the end of the world. And again, I just point to the zombie narratives. David McNally has a very interesting chapter in the book on interpreting the whole zombie phenomenon. So I think it's just very familiar to us, right? It's been, I think, really for several decades now in popular culture, end of the world scenarios are familiar. It's almost comfortable to talk about this. And, of course, it is morbidly fascinating to talk about some of the horrific details, and particularly around the environmental issue. I would say that part of the politics of talking about catastrophe, if we believe, in fact, that a catastrophe is upon us, is you want to kind of scare people straight, as the old war on drugs slogan would have it. If only people knew more about just how bad things are, maybe they would do something about it. And I think that there's certainly some merit to this. Now, obviously, if the catastrophe you're talking about doesn't itself have merit, such as Harold Camping's end of the world scenario, I think that was 3 years ago, you know, a fundamentalist minister predicting the end of the world, then all that work of educating people about the impending doomsday will go for naught, although there seems to be very little accountability for such prophecies. But in the case of the real catastrophe, and I would say, you know, climate change, biodiversity collapse, ocean acidification, this is the real phenomenon that's happening to the planet right now. I think there is a kind of sensibility that many environmentalists and scientists share, and I certainly share this myself very often, that if only people simply knew the facts and knew more about it, that they would do the right thing. And I think this is where we get into some interesting political questions, because we have to consider, historically, when presented with terrible information and catastrophic knowledge, do people necessarily do what, in this case, a scientist thinks should be done, which I believe is to suggest a complete retooling of the entire economic system, some way or another? There's a real impulse for those of us, and I'm sure most of your listeners, who know just about how bad the climate crisis is, to want to talk about this, and I think it's very important that we do so. But we also have to talk about what are the impacts of this knowledge, this information, and in particular, the fact that outside of the United States, where you still have climate denialism, and there's a few places where you have, you know, a climate denier movement, which is, of course, sponsored from the top, you know, top levels of think tanks, the petrochemical industry, and so on. But in most places in the world, that's really a diminishing factor. So we have to consider what are the solutions to the catastrophe that are being offered to us from the same people that brought us the crisis in the first place. That is the usual elites, business and government elites. And there is, I think, where we find it interesting, that we see that the solutions that are being offered, for the most part, to my view, and I think many of your listeners would agree, are not going to really solve the problem. And we can talk about what those solutions are. So in other words, simply knowledge of the problem is a stage, you might say, in doing something about it. But at a certain point, we have to really talk about the politics of where this is going. So to answer your question, though, I think that, yes, people are interested in talking about the catastrophe because, basically, because it's interesting. And sometimes the solutions, especially the technical solutions, they seem, to go back to the quote from the beginning, they seem unattainable given the existing political system. And therefore, you know, it's a little bit disheartening to even talk about it.
Well, I think, sure, Eddie, people are frustrated and they don't see a way out of this trap at this time or a way that they're willing to accept. And so one of the basic ideas of catastrophism is not that just things may collapse, but that they should fall apart so we can rebuild things like the economy or the social system or maybe an emissions-free world. What could go wrong with that idea, Eddie?
Yeah. Now, with different kinds of catastrophe over the years, there has been an idea that maybe the worse things get, the better they are in the long run, right? And so Sasha Lilly, in her chapter in the book, talks about this from a left-wing perspective, that it's historically some left-wing movements have made the case that, say, you have a reactionary political movement on the horizon, or that capitalism is facing, you know, some signs of structural crisis that takes the form of unemployment, for example, or even war. There has been a tendency on the left to say, well, maybe that's good. Let's enhance the contradictions. You know, bring it on. And then this will make clear to the masses that the system is broken and they will rise up. And so to make a long story short, you know, this has not always worked out the way it's been planned. Often when there's mass unemployment and economic crisis, the political elites are able to direct the anger about that away from the people in power towards scapegoats. And, of course, America, we're seeing an example of this right now with the Trump phenomenon, right? Why would working class white people who have been downwardly mobile for some decades support the billionaire who is blaming migrants and other spurious candidates as opposed to the system itself? Well, I mean, this is a familiar story. So the most egregious example that Sasha mentions, of course, in the book is a slogan of the Communist Party in Germany in the 1930s with regard to the ascendancy of the Nazi Party. They basically argued, well, maybe that's better than having the Social Democrats, you know, win again, who aren't going to do anything. And the slogan was, after Hitler, us.
Well, I've heard people come up with a version like that, some people on the left even, saying, well, maybe if we had 4 years of Trump and he dismantles the EPA and you know, he brings back the coal companies and Miami basically floods and things get really bad. Well, after Trump, then we'll get real climate action. But there's a real problem with accepting somebody who maybe has some fascist tendencies and certainly promotes violence.
That's right. And, you know, again, you have to look at each political situation in turn. It is true that in the United States in recent decades, when Republican is in power, you know, some left and liberal publications, you know, radio stations, for example, NGOs, environmental groups do see an increase in membership and donations. You do sometimes see greater mobilization on some issues. So, again, it's, you have to look at the entire picture. However, we really have to balance against what is the damage that could be done, right, by an administration that's avowedly anti-environment. And when you're talking about anti-civil liberties and against freedom of the press, that's sort of the parameter, the area in which social movements can operate. And another thing to throw in the mix here, of course, if you're talking about American politics and politics in many places in the world, is also liberal catastrophism, right, which is that liberals, and taking the establishment, you know, the Democratic Party, Hillary Clinton supporters, they really don't have much to say in defense of Hillary Clinton, but they can say, well, she's not Trump, right? And this, of course, is the lesser evil politics, which stampedes people into voting every 4 years for a candidate that doesn't represent meaningful change with regard to the environment, with regard to the killing of people of color by the police, with regard to many, many issues, wars, certainly. That's a whole other dynamic. That is, this lesser evil politics is going on as well. But yeah, I do think that the worse the better, we should be very cautious with this, these kinds of politics. And in particular, with the climate crisis and environmental crisis, there really doesn't seem to be a lot of time left for the planet to really make some significant changes in the entire system.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock, and I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Eddie Nguyen, and we are talking about catastrophism on both the right and the left. He's a radio producer, he's an author, and he teaches. We've got a good voice on this. Now, Eddie, I spent a couple of years reading about the Holocaust, and along the way, I was alarmed to discover how environmentally aware Hitler and some of his henchmen were. The German philosopher Martin Heidegger, a confirmed Nazi, spoke about a river's right to exist. The Nazis attempted to bring back former European animals, perhaps an attempt at rewilding, and Hitler was a vegetarian. It's a long list. Talk to us about the potential for ecofascism, maybe in America and then elsewhere.
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's, you know, I think people are always shocked when they discover some of these tendencies. You know, there's an assumption that environmentalism, green politics in general, are always sort of on the left, right? That they're complementary to feminism, to anti-capitalist politics, anarchism perhaps, socialism. And there is a lot of environmental politics we can now call environmental green politics that do share that lineage. However, there are other environmental strains of politics that come from a very different trajectory. You know, in the United States, it comes from elite conservation. You know, Teddy Roosevelt, you know, who's an imperialist. You have this whole masculinist project of socializing young men into the wilderness, big game hunting. You have various, really, a range of environmental politics. The green wing of the Nazi Party is an extreme version of this. And so thinking about, you know, 21st century environmental politics and confronting the climate crisis, I think some scholars are raising the issue of, well, down the line, could we see something like ecofascism, right? In other words, a kind of wedding of the right-wing politics that we're seeing, say, with Trump, that greenwashes itself, that basically says not only do we have to seal the borders for the real Americans, you know, in other words, a white supremacist kind of project, we also have to do this in the name of the environment. And we've seen versions of this in the past. We saw efforts by anti-immigration groups to infiltrate the Sierra Club some years ago, right, trying to blame illegal immigrants for environmental destruction. So I think we're starting to see this. I think it'll happen in Europe first with some of the new populist parties and racist parties in Europe taking this line of thought. And in particular, climate scientists are warning about the rising sea levels and the climate refugees, right? And this is already starting, by the way. You know, I mean, it's not just the Pacific Islands. You know, Bangladesh will be sort of a case in point. But many places, either through rising sea levels or crop failure, there's going to be a further displacement of vulnerable peoples in the world. And we already see what the reaction is in the rich world, and that's Europe, Australia, Japan, United States, which is sealing borders, right? And it's not just the far right now. This has become a mainstream position. So this is, I think, the immediate issue that we're going to sort of face is this kind of lifeboat ethics based on this idea that whether the poor are to be blamed for the environmental crisis or not, there's no room for them. and we have to divide the world into the haves and have-nots as it's already been divided. So I think this is a very pressing issue, and we may call it this kind of spaceship Earth model in which the life rafts are pulled up and the existing inequalities are reinforced.
We just had a major United Nations conference on environmental refugees and refugees in general. I think this is the headline story that will dominate for years to come. I recall the British scientist and inventor James Lovelock saying a few years ago that Britain, because it was sort of an island somewhat buffered by cooling seas, would become a climate lifeboat. And his plan was that the UK should start building more hospitals and more schools just to be ready for those refugees. But instead, what we've seen is the Brexit vote and a desire by many people to tighten the borders and keep everybody else out. Where's that going?
Yeah, so this is, it's just a really good example of why the environmental movement and the climate movement cannot be separated from movements for global justice and peace in the world. These things all have to be related. What this means from the point of view of environmentalists and scientists is they're going to have to also begin to learn more of the history that social scientists have traditionally been more concerned with about the inequalities of the world and the fact that they are not natural, right? So a big part of the problem is that people think when there's starvation or poverty in Africa, any place in the global south, that it's somehow natural, that people have made bad decisions, rather than seeing it as part of a 500-year history of enclosures and displacements and violence. And so what we're seeing now, to be on the positive side, is global movements that are putting these perspectives together, that in other words are not separating justice, whether it's a call for reparations or a call for a debt moratorium, a jubilee on debt, to stop the redistribution of wealth from the poorest nations to the richest, but in fact reversing that. We're seeing this movement around the world now, and in fact in the United States, the Standing Rock struggle in North Dakota against the Dakota Access Pipeline is an incredible example of this. So climate movements and social justice movements have to converge, and thankfully this is already happening. This is not an idea that we have to promote. If you just look around, it's there. It's all over the world, Latin America, Peru, Bolivia, battles against dams, against displacement. So there is a lot going on, but I do think on the other side of it, absolutely in the absence of those movements and that perspective, simply learning about the climate crisis without a historical background, many people in the rich world will be susceptible to kinds of eco-populist arguments of the right wing, suggesting that, well, it's unfortunate, but there's simply not enough to go around. There's scarcity. There's too many people. They're overpopulated over there. Those kinds of arguments are going to come back with a vengeance. And so it's going to be a real major battle of ideas, and this is why, again, to go back to the point about catastrophism, simple awareness of catastrophe is insufficient. There has to be, I think, an understanding of the history of it and the way that it's playing out in the world in very unequal ways.
And the way that it's playing out, you've talked about three general patterns of solutions to giant problems like climate change. Why don't we start with the technocratic idea?
Sure, yeah. In the absence of a more thorough debate and the intervention of social movements, you know, that are outside of the political establishment, you're going to see this crisis, like every other crisis, being filtered through the usual kinds of solutions. One of the solutions is simply a technical one, that every problem that the world system encounters or that capitalism produces can be solved through a simple technical, you know, fix. And the technical fix then will mean that the deeper issues creating the problem in the first place don't have to be addressed. And so, you know, again, I think the maximum example of this is geoengineering. And, you know, I think you probably had folks on your show, we will in the future, talking about this and some of the calamitous outcomes that may occur from some of these proposals. But suffice to say that it feels something like a spider that swallowed a fly kind of scenario, right? That you have a system of a domination of nature, I mean, making nature adhere to what the particular mode of production that wants it to be, finding problems with that, and then basically trying to modify it even further. You know, I think some of the technical solutions around carbon sequestering, around certainly renewable energies, are, I think, relatively benign. I think that these are things that should be advanced, but I think that they're also insufficient, right, without addressing the social inequalities, the massive overconsumption and overproduction, especially in the global north, that's fueling the crisis. Those have to be addressed. You can't simply say, well, we can just have more efficient, clean coal, you know, more battery-powered vehicles, and not actually have to change the way of life and the basic approach towards nature, which is looking at nature as a sink and a sewer to be disposed of and to be dumped on. So, again, I think the technical fixes are dangerous on several levels, in this case philosophically, but I think some of them could actually be dangerous in a deeper level, and I'm thinking, of course, about some of the geoengineering schemes.
Well, we already talked about ecofascism and eco-nationalism, but it seems like, and you mentioned this to me, the only solution acceptable to the New York Times is a neoliberal approach. Eddie Yuen, how do media power brokers see it, and why do they disagree even with the Pope?
Yeah, okay. So the Pope's encyclical was a surprise to many because it felt like he really listened to the climate justice movements in the world and put some of their ideas into the encyclical. And what, amongst those ideas is what we've been talking about, that you have to deal with the injustice, you have to deal with really a 500-year history. You can't, you know, simply blame the poor for making bad decisions, you know, that have led to their plight. And what was interesting is when this happened, I don't have the exact article in front of me, the New York Times had an article basically saying this is outrageous that the Pope would say this, because any serious economist knows that the only possible solutions are market-based. And it was kind of a pure expression of what Naomi Klein and many scholars have been talking about for years, about the hegemony, the dominance of neoliberal economics. In other words, it's impossible to, you're not permitted to think outside of the box and say, wait a minute, isn't there a way we can think about this crisis that actually challenges markets and more fundamentally challenges the commodification of nature? Because this is really what the neoliberal solutions are talking about. And what do I mean by that? If you look at the climate conferences and the big climate talks, the consensus view that is promoted as a solution to the problems is that maybe the atmosphere and carbon and water and other resources are undervalued. And so we have to use markets in order to value them better. And if we can make them fungible, that is, if we make them transferable and equivalent and put a price tag on them, then they can effectively be derivatives, as we saw with the derivatives in the housing market and other things. We see how that ends up. You know, that basically we can start trading atmosphere, carbon credits, perhaps fresh water, on markets. And so this is where we get carbon markets. We get cap and trade. I mean, cap is great. We should definitely cap carbon. What's this trading? What does this mean to trade carbon credits? Well, it effectively means dumping the carbon in the countries that are underpolluted, as Lawrence Summers, the Harvard economist, once said in the leaked email, that, you know, the global south may be underpolluted, and that's maybe the place that should be able to accept more pollution, and maybe they should accept more of the consequences of climate change, which, of course, are going to be global. So these kinds of solutions are still what's really on offer. We're still in this box, and it's very hard to think out of it. And, you know, the way I would, you know, really phrase it, it's catastrophic solutions to catastrophe, right? It's doubling down on the economic logic that brought us to this crisis in the first place. And really, we have to listen to the indigenous people in particular who have been very strong on this, saying, no, we have to actually decommodify fossil fuels, carbon, water, for that matter. We have to keep the oil in the soil and the coal in the hole, as many of the movements are saying in South Asia and Latin America. And really, we have to rethink what economy means and what prosperity means and what abundance means. So that, I think, is actually the primary mode of solution that we're going to be facing. Of the three that I mentioned, technical fixes, sort of this eco-nationalism, you know, drawing up the drawbridge, borders against climate refugees. But I think that this one, this neoliberal kinds of solutions, right, that is doubling down on climate capitalism, this is what is really on the table right now. And simply being aware of the facts of the climate crisis doesn't inoculate us from this logic. It's very hard to challenge this logic. And I think, as I said, I mean, it's being done right now from Standing Rock to South Africa to many places in the world. But this is, I think, where the real battle lies.
Well, let's go all the way. Why don't we put a market value on our children and start trading them too?
There we go. You know, or organs, right? Body parts.
Well, that's already happening.
Yeah, it has happened, but there's still some prohibitions against some organs, right? But, you know, for that matter, human lives, right? I think the analogy about abolition, with the abolition of slavery and the abolition of carbon, is really apt. You know, there's vested interests that don't want to see carbon being decommodified, because this is trillions of dollars of assets. Just as the banking industry of the 19th century was deeply invested in slavery, because they saw human bodies as assets. So the project of decommodification, of taking something which is being treated now as a commodity, as if it was made in a factory, and saying, no, this is something which is too important, either for ethical reasons or, in the case right now, with methane, carbon, and water, for planetary reasons. These cannot be treated as commodities. There are no market-based solutions to this. These things actually have to be protected, and if that means changing the entire system, then so be it. But that is the battle that has to be waged.
Radio EcoShock.
Here is more from the Against the Grain radio program on KPFA about the risks of believing in catastrophe as the way out of our deep crisis. Eddie's co-author and radio broadcaster, Sasha Lilly, explains.
It's very clear looking around us now during this crisis, looking at Europe, that the kind of chaos produced by an economic crisis often really gives a boost to the right, because it's very easy for the right to scapegoat other people. And during crises, people often don't do what we on the left would hope that they do. They don't necessarily turn to sort of mass solidarity and collective action. They often try and cope individually, sometimes try and exclude other people from the workforce based on their gender or their race, or migrate. And these are individual responses rather than collective responses, and the right tends to do very well from moments like that. It is, of course, possible for people to organize themselves during times of crisis or times of chaos, but there's nothing predetermined about how those will come out, and very, very often they come out well for the right.
Are you arguing that radicals should hope capitalist crises do not occur?
I think that's a pointless hope. Capitalism is about crisis. That is an essential part of it. During the 90s, there was that sort of brief moment of total delusion where people thought they had gotten away from crises, that, you know, the stock market could go up and up and up, and crises were a thing of the past. Clearly, crises are essential to the capitalist system, and as long as we have capitalism, we'll have crises. I think the lesson that we need to learn instead is whoever goes into the crisis with more strength, with more organization, with more groundwork laid, tends to do better during a crisis. So really, if there's any sort of practical implication for the left, it's that people should think about taking organization very seriously.
And you use the term in your chapter in this book, despondent politics. Can you explain that and tell us to what degree it might bind together some of the versions of catastrophism you've been talking about?
Catastrophism doesn't come out of a historical vacuum. I mean, as I mentioned, actually, it's been with the left for the past century at least. But I would argue that the last 40 years, there has been a particular despondency about the possibility to change society in any fundamental way, and hence people have tended to fall back into a kind of catastrophic view. If we don't have the collective action, the collective strength to change society, then let's just hope that something else will do it for us. Peak oil, a financial crisis. One could come up with a number of different scenarios, but these are essentially seen as external things that will create an opportunity that doesn't exist up into them. Now, there are many reasons why that kind of political despair has been operative, including, you know, the genuine failure of mass movements in the 70s, and one could spend a lot of time talking about those reasons, but just putting them to the side, I think that although the degree of despair that people have had about political change is understandable, we need to very strongly resist it, because it lends itself to very problematic politics. On the one hand, when the left indulges in scaremongering or fear, it can be very paralyzing to most people. People don't want to touch it.
That was Sasha Lilly, co-author of the book Catastrophism, The Apocalyptic Politics of Collapse and Rebirth. She was speaking on Against the Grain Radio in 2012. Find out more at kpfa.org or Against the Grain Radio on Facebook. I'll put a link to that Catastrophism program, broadcast November 12, 2012, in my own show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with author, broadcaster, and teacher Eddie Yuen from the San Francisco Bay Area. Well, in the book Catastrophism, The Apocalyptic Politics of Collapse and Rebirth, which is where we started, radio broadcaster Sasha Lilly asked if there is evidence that an economic downturn benefits the left, and what did she find?
Yeah, as I mentioned, you know, a little bit earlier, she found that the evidence is, in fact, not often the case, right? That is, and I think this has to do with, even more broadly, crisis often produces fear, insecurity and fear. And the politics of fear, we've concluded based on the research, tends to benefit the right more than the left. It tends to skew right. And this has to do with the asymmetry between right and left politics, right? That is, we think about this, you know, from the French Assembly in the revolutionary period, oh, you hear these two sides and they sort of balance each other out, and you have extremism of the left and extremism of the right. But in fact, they're actually quite different things, right? The psychological profiles are quite different, as research has shown. And some of the dynamics of politicization are different. And, you know, broadly speaking, on the left, you know, we're talking about a politics that is inclusive, a politics of empowering people, a politics of critical thought. I mean, that to me is a minimal definition of the left. And, you know, we could have some discussion of what that would include or exclude. But on the right, you have very deeply authoritarian tendencies in many forms of right-wing politics. And authoritarian tendencies are often buttressed by fear, right? And you can see this in the pop psychology, talking about the rise of authoritarianism around the world, you know, in Europe now, and Trump. What are these people doing? They're preying on fear. This week, it's fear of terrorism. That's one of the major fears. But certainly economic anxieties. These kinds of fears, the right wing can really go to town with. And so when you're talking about the example of unemployment, well, it's very easy to scapegoat something, right? It's very easy to scapegoat foreigners. In terms of the historical examples that we talk about in the book, rather than addressing the capitalist system as such, you have a particular ethnic group stand in for it. So this was the expression from the 19th century, 20th century, radical saying, anti-Semitism is the socialism of fools, right? That is, you often have a kind of let's blame a particular group rather than talking about a system. And in Asia, this is often, let's blame the Chinese, right? Let's blame some ethnic group. An ethnic group which is seen as elite, or also people at the bottom. So you have right-wing populism punches down and punches up. So it's very much bashing the people at the bottom, immigrants, people that are defenseless, but also this sort of vague criticism of elites, which in the West has often meant anti-Semitism and could be other groups in other parts of the world. So you have this kind of politics, which often results from an economic crisis. And, of course, can well-organized left forces speak to the crisis and actually begin to talk about the structural reasons why unemployment is happening or why people need a job in the first place in order to sustain themselves? Of course. And at certain times, this is the case. But the key point here is that it can't always be assumed that a crisis will necessarily lead to the kinds of politics that I think people that care about humanity and the planet would like to see. Very often, the same crisis can be mobilized by forces that want to scapegoat, that want to come up with some fanciful crackpot theory, and that want to basically build their own power structure, which may in fact not be particularly challenging to the one that exists already.
So, Eddie, tell us about the other authors in this book and maybe give us a bit of a peek into their viewpoints, if you can.
So Sasha Lilly wrote specifically about the left and the ways in which this the thinking that the worse the better has some role in some left politics. And we all also sort of mentioned liberal catastrophism, but they're really addressing it too much. But it's the kind of thing that, again, we encounter the most. We certainly encounter it every 4 years in the U.S., and that's the version that you'd better vote for the Democrat because otherwise the Republicans will take over the Supreme Court. And, you know, it's all going to be bad. And so you have to hold your nose and vote for the Democrat, who, of course, has endorsed all of the wars, you know, recent years, you know, signed on to the mass incarceration, the militarization of police, all of these things, right? So that's, I think, bundled into, I think, what Sasha's chapter is about, is just being attentive to the various uses of the invocation of catastrophe, which don't always work out maybe the way it's intended. James Davis, filmmaker, from Ireland, wrote a chapter on specifically on the right-wing catastrophism. And really, again, I think the key point here is fear, really the politics of fear and how, you know, it's very appealing. You can get people's attention with fear. And some of the stuff we're talking about is very scary. I think climate change is truly terrifying. But sort of going deeper into what are the kinds of responses to a politics of fear. And some of the examples from the right are really quite engaging. I mean, if you can have some humorous distance from it, it's, you know, it's a good read. But I mean, just to talk about some of the religious versions, there's millenarian versions of catastrophism, meaning a religious kind of end-of-the-world prophecy, which really gets people worked up. And then, of course, not surprisingly, there's some people that profit off of it. This goes all the way back to the 19th century. There was a guy named Miller, a minister, who... it was actually, he had a prophecy of the end of the world in the Midwest. It failed, and that was known as the Great Disappointment, because so many people had given up their farms and livelihoods and gone to the mountain waiting to be basically raptured up into heaven. In terms of those kinds of prophecies, we also have, some of them are benign. If people might remember a New Age version of this, the harmonic convergence, and it was unclear exactly what was going to happen, but it was sort of a benign kind of intervention. Just to talk about the religious kinds of catastrophes, there's an element of this you can see in other kinds of prophecies of catastrophe, which is something external to humanity is going to come in and sort things out. And I think that is a kind of impulse that we see with the appeal of catastrophism, broadly speaking, is it's too difficult to organize the people. It's too difficult to, you know, maybe go to where they're living, the neighborhoods or workplaces. But maybe if something external happens, some kind of shock that will wake up the masses. And I call this also the kind of the Paul Revere theory of waking people up. Just go around screaming enough and people will wake up and the scales will fall off the eyes and people will see. If the thing you're talking about is real, then there's some element that this could happen. But it's also, I think, it's a substitute for the kinds of organizing that's often more effective. And it also, again, to tie it into to James Davis's argument, it's a terrain that the right wing can really operate in very well because they love that politics of fear. That's a sweet spot for them. For those of us who are trying to envision a different kind of society based on solidarity, mutual aid, compassion, you know, fear is insufficient. Or fear can actually be something which maybe wakes people up a little bit, but you need to have something else as well. You need to build community. Finally, in the book, there is a chapter by David McNally, just a profound political economist, on the specific politics of zombies and the zombie movies and video games and films and the subculture around zombies. And it actually has, it's a historical piece on the relationship of the body to capitalism, expropriated labor, body snatching of the 19th century. And I just recommend people to read that. It's not as specific about the politics of catastrophe as about the specific phenomenon of zombies.
Yes, and people have had the Day of the Dead, and in medieval days they dressed up with blood on themselves, so that's been a long-running theme as well. Now, look, it's been 4 years since the publication, maybe almost five, of Catastrophism. Have you had continued interest in the book, and what are people saying?
Yeah, very definitely. And I think most people, you know, that have read the book, it's really been a great dialogue and response that's come from it, particularly, I think, around the question of politicization. To me, that's really kind of, in a sense, what it's about, is just getting, you know, folks to think about what is it going to take to kind of wake people up and to get people mobilized to do the kinds of work that's going to be necessary. And if simply knowing about how bad things are is not sufficient, and given that there's catastrophic solutions to the catastrophe that are already on offer, how do we talk about the catastrophe and simultaneously say, and we don't need more of this? You know, in other words, we don't need more, you know, climate capitalism. We don't need more neoliberalism. We don't need more fear-mongering. So that, I think, has been very helpful. But really what I would say is that in, you know, the last 4 or 5 years, there has been, thankfully, a real resurgence in a new kind of climate activism and a new social movements generally, right? I mean, you know, we wrote the book, it was the Arab Spring was happening, Occupy. But you have so many movements now around the world, and especially, you know, in North America, where things have been dormant for a very long time, and I'm really thinking about Black Lives Matter and the resurgent movements of people of color that have really changed the political climate in this country. And I don't think it's going to be a stretch for that movement, which I think has resilience, I think it's going to be around, to link up with the environmental movements that have been regrouping around facing the climate catastrophe and the calamity. So I really am actually quite optimistic now, and my earlier work has often been about social movements. I think that we're in a very exciting time of movement building, of new kinds of solidarities and alliances that are going to emerge. We're also, since Occupy, you got to give a lot of credit to Occupy, we're in a movement where it's possible, once again, to talk about capitalism, you know, and the specificity of capitalism, not just using it as a swear word, but understanding, well, what is this thing called capitalism? How is it different from other systems? What are some of the logics of capitalism that are antagonistic to the environment, to any kind of not only inequitable human society, but also to the very sustenance of life on Earth, right? So my research really is on extinction and the biodiversity crisis, which is just absolutely shocking. You know, the sixth extinction, if you want to call it that, that's been put out. I think that this crisis has to be thought of in the context of all the other crises taking place on the planet, the endless wars that are spreading from the Middle East, thanks to both Democrats and Republicans really instigating this 15 years ago, the ongoing internal domestic repression of people of color in the United States and other rich countries, not even considering the global majorities. All of these things, I think, are converging in a way that is really going to make some generative dialogue possible. So that's the big change, I would say, out of this.
Well, you've talked about positive movements, and I'd like to add another one, which is kind of a sleeper, doesn't get much press, but it really is the food movement. It's people who are not only looking for local food, but they're looking for holistic food, and now they're looking for food that will promise to put some carbon back into the soil, which is a widespread and benign help for climate change if we can get the carbon back in the soil, and I've interviewed people about that. But I want to return to a point here, and I will talk to you more about capitalism because I know you've researched that and it's a very important subject. But first, we've had the Utah physicist Tim Garrett on Radio EcoShock twice, and Tim published two widely respected scientific papers showing a formula that directly related economic wealth to greenhouse gas emissions. And by his calculations, and he says this bluntly, only a complete collapse of the current economy could save us in time from the worst climate disruption. You know, forget about solar panels and all those other things. They're not going to make it in time. Things have to fall apart to stop this gravy train of emissions hitting the atmosphere. How does that fit into our discussion today?
Yeah, well, I mean, I haven't seen the paper, but I mean, certainly there have, you know, there is a lot of discussion of among scientists about, you know, what are the, you know, the tipping points, the thresholds, you know, how soon are things going to hit certain places. But I think, to me, the starting point is that the climate catastrophe is not someplace in the future. It's already here. And I like to sort of paraphrase a quote by William Gibson, which is the future is not the future. It's just not evenly distributed. And I think the climate crisis is already here. It's just not evenly distributed. And so what's taking place is the very countries that were the most vulnerable to climate crisis were also the countries and parts of the world that were the most adversely affected by the last 500 years of imperialism, settler colonialism, and in the 20th century, sort of the late Cold War kinds of wars and counterinsurgencies. I think Christian Parenti's book, Tropic of Chaos, is a terrific book on this. And since I mentioned Christian Parenti, I want to maybe a quote of his about catastrophism, which was, I think, talking about some catastrophic scenarios, especially the Malthusian ones that talk about the scarcity as the fundamental problem, like we're going to run out of this, that, or the other thing, is that this is sometimes a hope masquerading as a fear, right? So in other words, when I think, you know, and again, on the right wing, it's very obvious when there's right wingers that talk about, you know, it's collapse is coming and we might as well embrace it. Of course, this is clearly their hope. I mean, they want to be the ones to pick up the pieces. But I do feel there's a kind of impulse to kind of clean the slate, let's just like sort this out, go back to a simpler life, and that would be fine. And if you're writing from Vermont or Northern California or someplace where you have a small-scale local community, which is most often very homogenous as well, and of course it's based on indigenous land, but people forget that, then it often looks sort of viable. Like, yeah, let's just cut the ties and, you know, let's think about a watershed, and that's great if only more people would see this, things this way. The problem is the world is, you know, one system. And for every Vermont, you know, and Northern California Valley, there are many more places that are living in the crisis as it's occurring right now. And if you look at what that collapse looks like, it's not a pretty thing. It doesn't fit the scenario, however, of the zombie movie, you know, the kind of like everybody fighting each other, depending on the level of destruction of the civil society by the last 500 years of empire and, in a counterinsurgency, it can be actually shocking how well people are holding together under these conditions. But nevertheless, when we see images of things going on in the Horn of Africa, droughts, famines, food scarcity, like Colombia now, indigenous people are starving, you know, in one area, so many places around the world, this is what the catastrophe looks like on the ground. And I certainly think from a political and moral perspective, it's not an exemplary thing, I think, to advocate an extension of this. So, you know, how then would we begin to think about the transition? You know, what would this take? Certainly, the overconsumption of the global north is an important starting point. And in fact, the overconsumption is not making people happy. So that's another starting point. I mean, people in the global north, we have planned obsolescence. We have to replace our phones every year. You know, all this stuff that's being produced is destroying the environment and communities down the commodity chain at this point of production. And, of course, at the point of final disposal, it's creating toxic landfills and incinerators elsewhere. So the entire chain of production and consumption has to be altered. And I actually think that this is something that's possible. I think enough people in the West that have all these commodities and, you know, have these high consumption lifestyles are actually realizing it's not that satisfying. So again, I think the problem is with the producers, not the consumers. I think one of the points, actually didn't mention this earlier, that I make in the book is that part of the reason that people feel disempowered when talking about climate crisis is that the solutions that we're being told from the elites are often individual consumer-based solutions. And those are clearly unsatisfactory, and I think people are smart enough to see that in the global north, and they basically reject those. And people say, you know what, I could use better batteries and light bulbs, but that's not going to, you know, stop this crisis. And they're right. Now, I do think that people, you know, should personal consumption be more virtuous, you know, recycle and compost, but that's not going to solve the problem. I mean, for every pound of trash produced in a household, 70 pounds of trash are created in the production of those commodities in the house in the global north. So really, you've got to deal with it in a much more systematic way. I think that the interesting thing about the technical side of it is that, you know, the renewable revolution, if you like, around wind and solar is actually further along than you might think. I mean, actually, you know, there actually are, I think, possibilities of a kind of, I don't want to say transition, I mean, I'm a little bit wary of that word, but certainly outside of a total collapse in the global north, which I think is very unlikely to happen, there are ways out, you know. But I guess the main take-home point I would say about the collapse is not evenly distributed. So when people are talking about collapse, it's like when they talk about overpopulation, it's always somebody else very often, you know. And I think if that argument holds, it's going to be ammunition to convince people to raise the drawbridge and to really double down on the emergent climate apartheid, which I think is already emerging. And we have to remember, too, that Canada, Greenland, you know, these are areas which in the short term are actually going to be very prosperous. As the ice sheets melt and as new lands emerge and new resources emerge, there's going to be a real boom in resource extraction, capitalism. There's going to be, you know, huge continents are basically reemerging, and they happen to be under the sovereign control of the very nations which, you know, have benefited from, again, the last 500 years of unequal development.
Yeah, Putin said that climate change would be great for Russia, open up Siberia to more farming, and a really great thing. So look, I know you've researched and written extensively on capitalism and the anti-capitalist movement. I'm wondering, is climate change really a symptom where the disease is capitalism?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting way to frame it. I mean, one way to, you know, I think to look at it is we talk about the modern world and capitalism, you know, capitalist modernity. It's kind of redundant. It's sort of like saying racial capitalism, and we have to say that now. But it's also, in a certain sense, redundant. I mean, capitalism, the world we live in, the modern world, is a capitalist world. It is a world of racial hierarchies, of a particular form of patriarchy, of various kinds of inequalities. And it happened that way for a reason. It's not that there's been a different kind of modernity that hasn't been capitalist. And therefore, you could say, well, you know, this crisis that we're in, the environmental crisis, is it, you know, a cause or effect or, you know, of capitalism? It's deeply related, and I think that there's a lot of very interesting work out there right now on the origins of capitalism in terms of environmental crisis. I think it's a very exciting time for environmental historiography. But I would just say, maybe as one sort of piece to start with, that the whole, I talk about the last 500 years, it's all possible because of what happens when Columbus discovers this hemisphere. And, you know, accidentally, you know, whatever you want to say, don't want to give it credit to the person, but the Columbian Exchange is kind of a big bang that makes everything possible because it brings in new crops into the world system that is a huge jumpstart to the caloric production, you know, of Eurasia and Africa. It's new lands which are made available to the settlers that arrive there because of the diseases which wipe out much of the population. There's also genocide, which further wipes out the population, and then the transference of millions of Africans to work this land. These are all phenomena that happen that create the wealth that allows this entire expansion to be possible. It's not equal in any way. It's deeply unjust. And this accompanies, of course, the transitions that happen within Europe, the transition from the crisis of late feudalism to, you know, the common story of the advent of capitalism in Europe. And I think we're adding more to that story all the time. For example, the witch burnings, the destruction of female knowledge, and especially knowledge around health and reproduction that Silvia Federici has documented in Caliban and the Witch, this incredible book on the witch burnings, understanding that the femicide of hundreds of thousands of women in the late Middle Ages was not this last gasp of superstition, but was in fact part of this rationalized modernity, which insists upon creating enclosures against not only the lands of people to displace them so they have to work in a wage labor situation, but also against knowledges, enclosures of knowledge, which are continuing to this day. So my answer to this is historical. I mean, there is only one world system. There is one planet that we live on, and these are the things that have shaped it. Now, we can call this by many names. I mean, I think capitalism is a word that makes sense to people around the world in terms of understanding this modernity, but we do have to be, you know, somewhat precise in talking about what this is, and not entirely moralistic either. I mean, I think sometimes we look at the great writings on the history of capitalism, say Karl Marx, people think about, if you read the Communist Manifesto, he actually, at times it sounds almost celebratory, because he's so excited by the possibilities that it's creating, and of course he's not nostalgic for pre-modern Europe, which, you know, he rightfully saw as often a place of injustice and superstition and, you know, things that he was opposed to as well. I think now we have, especially coming from the indigenous movements, a more nuanced view of what was lost in the transition to capitalism, the involuntary transition of the peoples of the world to being part of this global world market and the commodification of everything.
Which is still going on.
Which is still going on. And maybe that's a very important point to make about capitalism, is that sometimes we think that, you know, the big things have already happened and all we're doing now is improving the next iPhone, you know, and that the wealth is going to come from this innovation. So that's the kind of rhetoric we get from Silicon Valley. It's all about these great men, their innovations, and the new app. But in fact, if you look at where the wealth is really being generated, I mean, you know, in terms of firms, it's monopolies. I mean, Apple, Amazon, you know, same old story. It's not competition, it's monopoly. The competition is for the rest of us who have to compete with each other for housing and work. But, you know, you look at, like, where the wealth is being generated, it's from enclosures. It's still the expropriation and appropriation of lands, of labor, of resources from peoples in the world who had not thought of these things as commodities. You know, in other words, you know, the global commons. So there's a lot more talk about in the economics about commons and what are commons. And, you know, there's some debate around this. But I think one thing we, you know, have to be clear about is the relation of those commons to capitalism, that capitalism is always interested in taking something which is not seen as sellable, it's not seen as a commodity, and transforming it into that. And this often takes the form of a violent expropriation, expulsion from the land of people. And as you say, this is happening to this day. What are some of the key battles taking place, you know, in India around the dams, you know, in Belamonte Dam in Brazil, gold mines in Peru and Papua New Guinea? It's about displacing people from their lands so that multinational firms very often can come in and start extracting value in the form of mining, creating these dams, all these sorts of projects. And this is, in fact, the origin story of capitalism all over again. It hasn't stopped, right? This is continuing to this day. And this really is where a lot of the front lines of the battles are taking place.
Well, look, we're starting to run low on time, but given the risk of real catastrophe, what would you tell students or voters anywhere in the world? Do you think there's a sane path out of the fix we're in or not?
Yeah, I would have to say, I do think there's a sane path. I certainly, again, the starting point is, it's not that this is something in the future, right? The status quo of many people in the world, and possibly the majority, is already intolerable. I have a quote in the book from a Jamaican dub poet Lyndon Kwesi Johnson about the Cold War, and it says, "The eagle and the bear are people living in fear of impending nuclear warfare, but strange to see, believe it or not, many people don't care whether it's imminent or not." And it goes on to say that this hasn't been in 1982, that in the global north, people were worried about nuclear war, but in the global south, people were dying through the Cold War from the AK-47s and landmines that the United States and other countries were exporting to these countries. Most people in the global north didn't realize what had happened to Mozambique, Angola, Central America, all these countries through these horrific wars of the Cold War, except now, of course, when there's problems in Somalia, the Horn of Africa, or where there's gangs in Central America, then you'll get, oh, wow, there's a crisis there. It must be the culture. It's like, actually, you know, the Cold War produced these horrors, but in the global north, people weren't really paying attention. They were worried about the sort of big nuclear war, which fortunately did not happen. I think it was unlikely to have happened. And the point here is that it's uneven what's taking place. And so the crisis in the global south, whether it's crop failures, you know, the collapse of the food system, which has always been unequal since the days of the British and French empires, you know, creating economies in the colonies for exporting food while the people starved. This system is continuing to produce misery and suffering, and these problems will be exacerbated, right? As far as the crisis in the global north, it's quite possible that people won't even necessarily notice it in some cases. I mean, the Great Depression, there were American elites who were living under mansions on the Hudson that didn't know there was a depression. It's significant, I think, that, you know, that the concentration of wealth is so high right now that, you know, the billionaires, they feel that they can escape whatever crisis is going to happen. You know, it's always funny to me that Dick Cheney and Rumsfeld have their mansions in the mountains amongst the many houses that they own, maybe just in case, right? I think it's Taos, New Mexico, and Wyoming. So they've got their bases covered, so to speak. And very rarely do things happen to them. And I think it's important to remember that as long as the global elites, you know, business and political elites feel that they're exempt from the crisis, then it's not truly a global crisis. You know, until something happens to persuade them or to just overpower them to make decisions based on the majority of the planet. So I want to just conclude with the way I often begin these talks on the book, which is the problem with talking about the catastrophe, the environmental catastrophe, really comes to a simple word, which is we. Who is the we? And every time we say we, like we, humanity, are in this crisis around, you know, the planetary climate crisis, we're already sort of buying into a notion that humanity is united, and by implication that our leaders are making decisions with the interest of all humanity in mind. And sad to say, that's not the case. It hasn't been the case for 500 years. It hasn't been the case even within the U.S. Historically, and it's certainly not the case now. In fact, the world now is more polarized by wealth than it's maybe ever been. That is, the disparities between and within the rich nations and poor nations, and between even within a rich country like the U.S., are so profound that the elites simply, they don't, when they're saying we, they mean we as in General Motors, the business of America is business. Their we is not the same as the we for the global majorities. And I think that this is something that environmentalists and scientists, for all the right reasons, right, they often move to this we. They often talk about us and the planet because they're making this kind of move. They're thinking at the level of species, and this is admirable. But I think it's important also to have a historical perspective and say, you know, when that we is invoked, you really have to look at who's saying this. Who does that include? And most importantly, who does that exclude? And the people that have been excluded from that we, which includes the notion of humanity itself, those are the people that I think are doing the most interesting work very often. And again, I want to go back to Standing Rock. You know, this is one of the poorest native sovereign nations in the country, and yet people are making a stand that's inspiring the world. And this is the case with many of these struggles on frontline communities around the planet. I think people have to get in where they fit in. People have to, that aren't in frontline communities, can do a lot of work wherever they are. But I would certainly be wary and skeptical of plutocrats invoking humanity as they justify further neoliberal climate solutions on the grounds that the crisis is so dire that there's no time for debate and there's no alternative.
We have been talking with the author, radio producer, and teacher Eddie Yuen. He's part of the Against the Grain radio show on KPFA Pacifica, and he's a contributor to the book Catastrophism, the Apocalyptic Politics of Collapse and Rebirth, published by PM Press. Eddie, I really admire your ability to marshal facts and history for us. Thank you so much for your contribution to Radio EcoShock listeners.
It's been a great pleasure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for supporting Radio EcoShock and caring about our world.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Yanis Varoufakis, How Do We Get the Russian Troops to Withdraw from Ukraine? This is a passionate appeal for peace by the former academic and Minister of Finance. After resigning from the Greek government in 2015, Yanis Varoufakis did not return to academia. He's now engaged in European politics as a visionary speaker, writer, and active participant. In February 2016, he launched the Democracy in Europe movement and is active in the building and social justice and financial goal setting of the European Union and holds a parliamentary seat since July 2019. The first clip you will hear is Varoufakis' message for peace in Ukraine to the Progressive International. It was launched when the Democracy in Europe movement and the Sanders Institute in Vermont made an open invitation for progressive forces to join across all borders. Varoufakis records from his kitchen for the meeting on March 9, 2022.
Hello, this is Yanis Varoufakis with a message on behalf of Mera 25, a political party here in Greece, and TM25, our pan-European movement, a message to comrades participating in the Peace Forum of the Progressive International. These are very dire times, so you'll allow me a very personal message. When a country or a region is invaded, I feel as if I'm being overpowered by a duty to take the side of the people facing troops with direct orders to violate their homes, to bombard their neighborhoods, to destroy the circumstances of their existence, of their very life, and to do so without hesitation, unconditionally. When I see civilians in the Ukraine preparing Molotov cocktails by which to fend off the invaders, I cannot but cheer them on. Independently of the history of Ukrainian politics, independently of how their government came about, independently of whether they actually like their government, defending the right of Iraqis to defend themselves from advancing American troops back in 2003 had nothing to do with an acceptance of the vile Saddam Hussein. Which brings me painfully to note the double standards of the West. On the one hand, a 15-year-old in Qalqidiyah throwing stones at advancing Israeli army bulldozers whose purpose is to demolish this kid's home, the West calls her or him a terrorist. But when Ukrainians throw Molotov cocktails, they're heroes. To help Ukrainians today, morally, in this struggle for existence, effectively, we first need to demonstrate that we use the same moral compass, whether we are in Ukraine, Iraq, or Yemen. Only the other day, the Saudi Arabian Air Force bombarded Yemen 37 times in one day. To ignore the Yemeni victims of Western Saudi aggression is to diminish humanity's capacity to show solidarity with Ukrainians and also our capacity to chastise Putin. Treating some victims of invasion as more deserving than others lessens our capacity to stand with any victims and all victims. To help Ukrainians find the path to peace and freedom, which is the number one priority, or should be the number one priority, we must also choose to put their interest above our fixations and ideologies. I am a left-winger, but while people in the Ukraine are dying, I do not have the right to focus on whether President Zelensky is a good Democrat, left-winger, his political biases, whether these are to my liking. It is irrelevant. Similarly, I hope that those who have completely different politics to mine, they may really like NATO and think that the European Union is the best thing that could happen to Ukraine, I hope that they put those predispositions, you know, very much lower on their list of priorities than the right of Ukrainians to live in freedom, peacefully and independently. So the only question that we need to ask ourselves now is this. How do we get the Russian troops to withdraw from the Ukraine? Any other question must wait. We know how Russian troops will not withdraw. We know that NATO is not going to come to the assistance of Ukrainian fighters. There won't even be a no-fly zone, despite Zelensky's requests. So how do we stop Putin from eventually occupying large parts of the Ukraine, with immeasurable medium and long-term costs for the Ukrainians, for the Russians, for Europe, for the world? There are only two possibilities, a diplomatic solution or regime change in Russia. Anybody who believes that the sanctions, the war, the continued campaign against the whole of the people of Russia, as if it is the fault of the people of Russia, as opposed to just Putin's and his regime. Anybody who believes that all this is going to bring about regime change and is banking on regime change to save the Ukrainians is placing the interest of the people of the Ukraine and, of course, everybody else very low in their list of priorities. A diplomatic solution is the only thing which is consistent with humanism, with rationality, and with peace. While this conflict is raging, we need to keep in mind what Putin is capable of. The more the brave Ukrainians are resisting Russian troops, the nearer we're getting to a Grozny-like, vile outcome. Remember who Putin is. To solidify and stabilize his fledgling presidency back, 20 years ago or so, he flattened Grozny. He turned it into Dresden. What's going to stop him from doing the same thing with Kyiv? So this is not a theoretical question. It's a question of saving tens of thousands of lives with a diplomatic solution that the West, unfortunately, does not seem to be considering seriously, with their fixation of the right of Ukraine to become a NATO member or a EU member. This is a theoretical right that has no bearing upon the reality of Ukrainians today. So what would an agreeable diplomatic solution look like? It would comprise three aspects. First, an immediate ceasefire and withdrawal of Russian troops. Secondly, the opportunity for Putin to portray any deal, any agreement, as a kind of victory for him. And third, whatever agreement comes about must be jointly guaranteed by Moscow and the United States, by Washington. And to have any credibility and utility in the long term, it must involve a whole process of de-escalating tensions between NATO, Poland, the Baltics, the whole caboodle, and Russia. Is there a chance that Putin would agree to something like this? Absolutely. He's a ruthless killer, I have no doubt about that. But he's not mad and he's not stupid. He knows that his economy cannot sustain a long-term occupation of the Ukraine, nor can his military. He knows that the way in which his central bank was cut off from the international system of central banks, eventually this is going to bring his regime down. Maybe in 10 years, maybe in 15 years, but he knows it. So he would be interested in a deal that does two things, gives him a way out and also allows him to go to his regime, to his oligarchs and say, look, I stopped the eastward expansion of NATO and I got the United States to grant Russia the respect that it deserves in the context of a summit between Biden and Putin. Now, of course, such an agreement would leave everybody slightly dissatisfied, but it would give the Ukrainians the chance to rebuild a free, democratic and independent Ukraine. Many issues will need to be solved. For instance, the European Union can pour large quantities of money, if we care, as we say we do, about the Ukrainians, into rebuilding the Ukraine well before there is any discussion about the Ukraine's accession to the European Union. At the same time, once Washington and Moscow jointly guarantee an agreement, you can have a demilitarized zone along the Ukrainian-Russian border, and the contested Donetsk and Luhansk regions could be administered and along the lines of something like the Northern Irish Good Friday Agreement, which allows for a kind of joint sovereignty. Both Dublin and London are overseeing it with the European Union. A deal of that nature would be ideal even for this highly contested area between Russia and the Ukraine. Is this going to work? Who knows? What I do know is that the alternative is a long-term occupation spelling in the long run, too long for the Ukrainians to benefit, major crisis in Russia that may, who knows, even yield something worse than Putin. The option of an independent yet neutral Ukraine, along the lines of Austria, Sweden, Finland, countries that managed to build free democratic societies because of their neutrality during the Cold War. That is a real option for the Ukraine today. Possibly the only one. Anyone who places the theoretical right of the Ukrainians to join NATO and the EU really doesn't care about the Ukrainians. They care a lot more about NATO's image or the EU expansion. But is this the priority today? Comrades, friends, it is precisely at times like this, when the people of Europe are being railroaded into taking the side either of Putin or of NATO, that an organization like ours, the Progressive International, must break the deadlock and point to the only alternative, which is progressive internationalism, democracy, and yes, non-alignment with either the military-industrial complex of the United States, the CIA and NATO, or with the brutish misanthrope, Vladimir Putin, who, having sat on the necks of his own people, is now invading the people of Ukraine. Carpe diem.
That was the former Greek finance minister and academic Yanis Varoufakis, recording his message to the Progressive International meeting on March 9, 2022. On March 6, 2022, the British comedian and YouTuber, with a following of over 5 million, invited Varoufakis for a conversation about peace in Ukraine. Russell Brand gave it the title, "So This is Why Ukraine is Being Attacked," and after a brief introduction, turned the broadcast over to Varoufakis.
So, I hand over the podcast to you, Yanis Varoufakis. See you in an hour.
I hope you won't abandon me so quickly. Look, first things first. When there's an invasion, we must always take the side of the people who are facing troops with direct orders to violate their homes, to bombard their neighborhoods, to destroy the circumstances of their lives. And I say that without any hesitation and unconditionally. This is not something that our Western rulers do. I say this regarding the Ukrainians. When I see Ukrainians in Kharkiv, for instance, putting together a Molotov cocktails by which defend their homes from the advancing Russian tanks, I applaud them. But our rulers applaud them while at the same time, when there is a 15-year-old kid in Kalkidia, in the Palestinian territories, throwing a stone at an advancing bulldozer with the intent to demolish his home, they call him a terrorist. So we make no such distinctions. We support the defenders of their homes, of their neighborhoods, of their communities. So today we stand with Ukraine, unconditional. No ifs, no buts, no conditionalities attached. To help Ukrainians at this very moment in time, we need to apply the same moral compass, universally, making the distinctions between fashionable, deserving victims in the Ukraine and unfashionable victims in Yemen, where only 48 hours ago, there were 37 sorties by Saudi Arabian bombers taking out civilians in Yemen. My simple point is that to support the Ukrainian victims of Russian aggression, you have to support the Yemen victims of Saudi aggression. Let's forget about our little ideologies at the moment. When there are people who are dying, their circumstances, their situation must prevail and must trump our own little political projects, whether it is my political project, your political project, or NATO's political project. So the question now is, how do you stop the carnage? How do we get the Russian troops to withdraw back to their bases? And how do the Ukrainians get a chance to fight it out amongst each other, not with weapons, but with the power of arguments between the leftists and the rightists, between the communists in the Ukraine and the Nazis? And there are Nazis in Ukraine. This is not a reason to bomb Ukraine. In this country, in my country, at some point, the Nazi organization called Golden Dawn was the third largest party. So what? You bomb Greece because we have the serpent's egg hatching in our midst? No. What you do is you create the circumstances for democratic politics in Greece, in the Ukraine, in Yemen, to fight Islamist fundamentalism, Nazism, fascism, you know, Boris Johnson, whatever. So how do we get the Russian troops out of there? NATO is not proposing to invade, and that's a good thing, because if NATO invaded now in support of the Ukrainians, we would have Third World War, and, you know, climate change wouldn't get a chance. We would have destroyed the planet before climate change was completed. When I see the Ukrainian resistance fighters putting up a great struggle and preventing the Russian tanks from entering Kiev, you know, I celebrate with them. But I know who Putin is. Putin is a ruthless killer. He proved that when in 2000, he flattened Grozny. He destroyed a city of 250,000, 300,000 people in Chechnya, just in order to solidify his hold over the Russian government. He's perfectly capable of, you know, like he turned Grozny into Dresden, turning Kiev into Dresden. So I shudder to think if he does it. So the more our Ukrainian comrades resist his army, the more likely it is that we are going to have that. I'm not suggesting that they should stop resisting. If I were them, I would keep fighting, you know, come what may, even if he flattens the city. But we, from where we are, from the comfort of our own home or studio or whatever, we have a moral imperative to try to find a solution that we could sell to Putin that saves all these tens of or hundreds of thousands of people in the Ukraine and gives them a chance to breathe and a chance for democracy and a chance for independence. Now, the question is, what is there anything that Putin would buy as part of such a deal? And I think there is. I think that Putin is ruthless and a killer and a war criminal, Chechnya, right? but he's not dumb. He's a highly trained strategist for the KGB. He knows that he cannot occupy the Ukraine forever. He knows that he's going to have something worse than Vietnam in his hands. He knows that the Russian economy is smaller than the economy of Texas, by the way, in terms of gross domestic product. Yeah. He doesn't have the funds to continue. He has the funds to continue to do a lot of damage to the Ukrainians, okay, to destroy a whole generation. But he cannot hold Ukraine, and he cannot hold Russia if he continues, you know, along the lines of a modern Afghanistan for 5, 6, 7, 8 years. So he's looking for a way out. And even if he's not looking for a way out today, he will be looking for a way out next week. And what is this way out that we can offer him, which is consistent with the interests of the Ukrainians and the rest of the world? Imagine if there was an offer by President Biden, because the European Union doesn't count. They're just the blackies of the US. But Biden could hold a summit with Putin, and a quid pro quo could emerge, the quid pro quo being very simple. Russia withdraws from Ukraine. There is an agreement for the demilitarization of Donbas and the region around the borders between Ukraine and Russia. There can be some bargaining regarding particular plots of land, Crimea and so on. And both Russia and the United States guarantee the neutrality and independence of Ukraine. Anybody who says that all that's giving in to Putin will have to answer, what is the alternative? The alternative is carnage, a prolonged occupation, permanent division of the Ukraine in the long run, and the toxification of politics both in the Ukraine and in Russia. Look, amongst all this unpleasantness and distress that we all feel, I had some fantastic news today. The Progressive International, which is this body that we set up with Bernie Sanders back in 2018, and now we have organizations representing something like 200 million people around the world, we received a letter signed by several organizations of Russian socialists from Moscow, from St. Petersburg. And allow me to read just a few extracts, I won't bore you too much, of what they say. So these are Russians in Russia today, not emigres, in Russia today, taking huge, huge risks, writing this and sending this to us and asking us to publish it. So here we go. We are told, they say, that the opponents of this war are hypocrites and that they stand not against the war, but for the West. This is a lie. This is Russian speaking. We have never been supporters of the United States and its imperialist policies. When Ukrainian troops shelled Donetsk and Luhansk, these are the eastern provinces with quite a few Russian speakers in the Ukraine that were sort of annexed, quasi-annexed by Putin in 2014. We were not silent, say the Russians, nor would we be silent now when Kharkov, Kiev, and Odessa are being bombed on the orders of Putin and his camarilla, his entourage. There are so many reasons to fight against the war. For us advocates of social justice, equality and freedom, they are especially important. This is an invasion. No threat to the Russian state exists. But go on, I won't bore you reading the whole paragraph. This war produces incalculable disasters for our peoples. Both Ukrainians and Russians are paying for it dearly with their blood. Long after the dust has settled, poverty, inflation and unemployment will affect everyone, and they continue. This war will turn Ukraine into rubble and Russia into a prison. This is Russians speaking. The opposition media have already been shut down in Russia. People are placed behind bars. Soon, Russians will have only one choice, and that is to rise up. Or prison. This war multiplies all the risks and threats to our country. Russia, they mean. Even Ukrainians, who a week ago sympathized with Russia, are now enlisting in the militia to fight our troops. Finally, fighting for peace is the patriotic duty of every Russian, not only because we are the custodians of the memory of the worst war in history, Second World War, when 20 million Russians died, or Soviets, but also because this war threatens the integrity and very existence of Russia. And they finish off with this beautiful paragraph. Putin is seeking to connect his own fate with the fate of our country. If he succeeds, then his inevitable defeat will be the defeat of the entire nation. Then we may indeed face the fate of post-war Germany, occupation, territorial division, the cult of collective guilt. There's only one way to prevent these catastrophes. We ourselves, the men and women of Russia, have to stop this war. This country belongs to us, not to a handful of distraught old men with palaces and yachts. It is time to take it back. Our enemies are not in Kiev and Odessa, but in Moscow. It is time to kick them out. War is not Russia. War is Putin and his regime. That is why we, Russian socialists and communists, are against this criminal war. We want to stop it in order to save Russia. No to intervention, no to dictatorship, no to poverty. Russell, that was the best news I've had since the beginning of this invasion, reading this piece.
You heard two recordings with Yanis Varoufakis on the question of how do we get the Russian troops to withdraw from Ukraine. Most recently, he was the guest on Russell Brand's YouTube channel. The posting date is March 6, 2022. Varoufakis' recommendations on how to bring about peace in Ukraine are widely supported in Europe. The future of NATO is crucial in negotiations for peace, and there's much disagreement over NATO's history and the power plays in the background. Here's an especially interesting example of a crowdsourced collection of critical comments on NATO on a Twitter thread, at Arno Bertrand. They include famous people such as Noam Chomsky and CIA Director Bill Burns, and Clinton's Defense Secretary, William Perry, and all are backed by video or text links. I will use the remaining minutes of this radio program to get to as many as possible. The working title of this collection is How Western Strategic Thinkers Warned U.S. NATO Over Ukrainian Conflict. The first entry is well known, George Kennan, the architect of the U.S. Cold War strategy, warned in 1998 that NATO expansion was a tragic mistake. Henry Kissinger in 2014 warned that to Russia, Ukraine can never be just a foreign country. He was adamant that Ukraine should not join NATO. John Mersheimer, a leading geopolitical scholar in the U.S. today, said in a video in 2015, quote, the West is leading Ukraine down the primrose path, and the end result is that Ukraine is going to get wrecked. What we're doing is, in fact, encouraging that outcome. Clinton's defense secretary, William Perry, explained in his memoir that to him, NATO enlargement is the cause of the rupture in relations with Russia, and that in 1996, he was so opposed to it that, in the strength of my conviction, I considered resigning. Noam Chomsky, public intellectual, said in an interview in 2015 that, quote, The idea that Ukraine might join a Western military alliance would be quite unacceptable to any Russian leader, and that Ukraine's desire to join NATO is not protecting Ukraine. It is threatening Ukraine with major war. Stephen Cohen, the late famed scholar of Russian studies, warned in 2014 that if we move NATO forces towards Russia's borders, it's obviously going to militarize the situation and Russia will not back off. This is existential. CIA Director Bill Burns said in 2008, Ukrainian entry into NATO is the brightest of all red lines for Russia, and I have yet to find anyone who views Ukraine and NATO as anything other than a direct challenge to Russian interests. Former U.S. Defense Secretary Bob Gates wrote in 2015, moving so quickly to expand NATO was a mistake. Trying to bring Georgia and Ukraine into NATO was truly overreaching and an especially monumental provocation. Pat Buchanan, in his 1999 book, A Republic, Not an Empire, wrote, by moving NATO onto Russia's front porch, we have scheduled a 21st century confrontation. In 1997, a group of individuals, including Robert McNamara, Bill Bradley, and Gary Hart, wrote a letter to Bill Clinton warning that the U.S.-led effort to expand NATO is a policy error of historic proportions. Sir Roderick Lyne, former British ambassador to Russia, warned a year ago that, quote, pushing Ukraine into NATO is stupid on every level. If you want to start a war with Russia, that's the best way of doing it. Also last year, famous economist Jeffrey Sachs, in a column in the Financial Times, warned that NATO enlargement is utterly misguided and risky. True friends of Ukraine and of global peace should be calling for a U.S. and NATO compromise with Russia. And Fiona Hill, presidential advisor, said, we warned George Bush that Mr. Putin would view steps to bring Ukraine and Georgia closer to NATO as a provocative move that would likely provoke preemptive Russian military action. These are some of the first 19 entries from an ever-expanding Twitter thread at Arnaud Bertrand, how Western strategic thinkers warned U.S. NATO over Ukrainian conflict. Before March 15, a participant in this research effort posted a link to a speech by Senator Biden.
I think the one place where the greatest consternation would be caused in the short term for admission would be to admit the Baltic states now in terms of NATO-Russian, U.S.-Russian relations. And if there was ever anything that was going to tip the balance, were it to be tipped in terms of a vigorous and hostile reaction, I don't mean military, in Russia, it would be that.
That was Senator Joe Biden on C-SPAN on June 20th, 1997. Peace in Ukraine. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, TUC Radio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.